Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om namo Bhagavate Chama. Shiravasa.
Shiravasa.
Wearing old garments. Vratachama.
Vratachama.
Lean and thin on account of austerities. Veni Bhuta. Entangled. Shiroruha. Her hair. Bhavo.
Shishon.
Upapatim.
Near the husband.
Shanta.
Peaceful.
Shika.
Flames.
Shantam.
Shantam.
Without being agitated.
Eva.
Like.
Analam.
Fire.
Fire.
Translation. The daughter of King Vidarbha wore old garments, and as she was lean and thin because of her vows of austerity, since she did not arrange her hair, it became entangled and twisted in locks. Although she remained always near her husband, she was silent and unagitated as the flame of an undisturbed fire. I'm not really sure what's supposed to happen because there's two verses on the board and they both have purports. Do I read them both? I kind of feel a bit awkward giving class because with this Mayapur Academy right now, we're just so busy. I haven't had time to come to class, so I kind of didn't think that I should be giving class. So verse 43, Patim Parama Dharma Jyam Vaidavi Malayadvajam Premna Paya Charadgitva Bhogansa Pati Devata. Translation, the daughter of King Vidarbha accepted her husband as all in all, as the supreme. She gave up all sensual enjoyment and in complete renunciation followed the principles of her husband, who was so advanced. Thus she remained engaged in his service. And I'll read this one again so you see the continuity of it. The daughter of King Vidarbha wore old garments and she was lean and thin because of her vows of austerity. Since she did not arrange her hair, it became entangled and twisted in locks. Although she remained always near her husband, she was as silent and unagitated as the flame of an undisturbed fire. So Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur points out that four verses here, 43, 4, 5, and 6, are actually discussing the guru-disciple relationship. And we see that, I'll read the purport in a moment. Srila Prabhupada talks about this in the purport. And the analogy is drawn here between the relationship between a husband and wife and a guru and disciple, and how the wife sees the husband as spiritual master. And I remember when I first got married, I kind of had this idealistic notion that my wife was going to see me as her guru and you know, bow down and all this kind of stuff. But marriage is an interesting arrangement where we come to confront the nature of who we really are, because as in most relationships, you know, if there's something you don't like about the relationship, you can easily go your own way. But marriage and Krishna consciousness is not like that. It's a very responsible situation where we need to see it through. And as a result of marriage, I feel that I've actually learnt a lot about myself and I learnt a lot about how to interact with others. And, you know, I think my expectations or my perception of myself has become a lot more realistic. And in this verse, or the purport here particularly, we see how Srila Prabhupada, and in this section actually, he's talking about the nature of Malayadvaj, and he was actually a great devotee, a very, very elevated soul. So much so that in one of the previous verses, Srila Prabhupada is describing that he was such a powerful devotee, this Malayadvaja. And he's saying Malaya means like the Malaya hill, you know, steady and unmoving. And Dvaja, it can refer to a flag, it can refer to other things, but he's such a powerful devotee that he enables other devotees to become steady and strong like himself. And then Srila Prabhupada indicates that he's a Mahabhagavat in one of the previous purports. So Vaidarbhi, who was, as we know, Paranjan in a previous life, married, because of her pious activity, she actually married this great personality, which then enabled her, you know, as we see in the sixth chapter of the Gita, Krishna is pointing out how that if one, was it Prakpitam Lokam, that how, after practice devotion, sort of performing pious activities, one gets born into a family of rich aristocracy or brahmanas. And this is what's happened to Vaidarbha. So she's been put in a situation due to her piety where she's actually been exposed to bhakti so that she can actually take up the devotional process. And now she's in this situation where her husband's performing austerities in order to perfect himself. And she's also gone with him because of her affection for him. And now she's also performing austerities. And as a result of them... and Prabhupada makes this point quite clearly in this section, as a result of them not pursuing material desires and ultimately giving up the material desires, particularly sex desire, then they're actually making solid advancement in devotional service, whereby they become qualified to go back home to Godhead. Because as long as the jiva is endeavouring to enjoy themselves in the material world, they cannot make serious advancement in devotional service. Something may be there, but as long as we're trying to enjoy the senses, then this blocks us. This is an obstacle or an anatta on the path of devotional service. And Srila Prabhupada would often say that, you know, spiritual life and material life go ill together, just like water and oil. And this experiment, you can try it out. You put water in oil and it floats. But if you shake the bottle, it all mixes up for a little while. It goes milky white. And for a little while, it looks like it's mixed. But you put it down and let it sit for a while, and you see what happens is the oil again will rise. So it's like that. It's like we may think that we're mixing, you know, the two, but after some time we'll see that actually this is not working, that actually you can't mix these two. So it's very important here. And in the second verse, the analogy is given there, it mentions here, she was silent and unagitated as the flame of an undisturbed fire. And then Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, in his commentary and also his translation of this verse, he translates it as being like the coals or the embers. Because you see the embers, they give off light and heat, but there's no smoke. So it's saying like she became completely peaceful like that, where she wasn't agitated at all. And as a result of serving her, you know, Mahabhagavata husband. So I'll read. Is there any, I mean, which purport shall I read? Shall I read one or both? Or? Figuratively, King Malayadwaj is the spiritual master, and his wife Vaidarbha is the disciple. The disciple accepts the spiritual master as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, as stated by Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur in his Guru Vashtaka, Sakshid Haritvena. One accepts the Guru, the spiritual master, as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One should accept the spiritual master not in the sense that the Mayavadi philosophers do, but in the way recommended here. Since the spiritual master is the most confidential servant of the Lord, he should be treated exactly like the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The spiritual master should never be neglected or disobeyed like an ordinary man. If a woman is fortunate enough to be the wife of a pure devotee, she can serve her husband without any desire for sense gratification. If she remains engaged in the service of her exalted husband, she will automatically attain the spiritual perfections of her husband. If a disciple gets a bona fide spiritual master, simply by satisfying him, he can attain a similar opportunity to serve the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Srila Prabhupada makes a similar point in the fourth chapter, that verse Tadvidi Pradipatena, where he says that, you know, satisfaction of the self-realized spiritual master is the secret to success in devotional service. So simply by serving the Guru, and satisfying him through one's service and service attitude, then one will achieve all success. Yesterday we had a very interesting class where Jinanasaru was speaking about service attitude. It was the values and attitudes of a Vaishnava and a Pujari. And we projected up on the board this picture of an iceberg. And as you all know, an iceberg is the expression, the tip of the iceberg. So just what's sticking above the water is very, very small compared to what's below the water. So in the same way, we in devotional service or just in general, there's the form of something, which is what we all see, but then there's actually the values and the attitudes that are driving this. And the point we were making yesterday, that in devotional service, we may see, you know, someone can dress very nicely and wear tilak and all these different types of things and look like a Vaishnava. But this is not really what is the estimation or how a Vaishnava is judged. But a Vaishnava is judged by the values they hold true, by the attitudes they have. You know, Prabhupada sometimes would say that, you know, if one has an appropriate service attitude, then you're 50% there. So by having the appropriate service attitude, which is driven by the values that one has, then we can actually achieve success in spiritual life. So it's the same in the guru-disciple relationship, which we'll see here over the next few verses. It talks about the attitude that the disciple should have towards the spiritual master. And this is one of complete surrender. And Prabhupada mentions here in this purport that the spiritual master should never be neglected or disobeyed like an ordinary person. It's like when we're having dealings with ordinary persons, you know, and they may give us some instruction or some suggestion or whatever, we don't necessarily have to follow that. But if the guru is giving us direction, because the point is, why are we approaching a spiritual master? Just because we want to say, I have a guru, I can wear my guru badge, you know, and say that I've got a guru and therefore I'm okay and all that. The point of approaching a spiritual master is to receive instruction on the path of devotional service with a view of ultimately going back home to Godhead. And the spiritual master, as is pointed out in the fifth canto, the beginning of the fifth chapter, that one should not become a spiritual master. And it mentions all different types of spiritual masters, you know, like a father, a husband, a worshipful demigod. It mentions all these different types of things that one shouldn't take on this role unless you're capable of delivering dependence from the cycle of repeated birth and death. So this is, you know, to take on the responsibility of guru is a very heavy thing. And we've seen, you know, not just within ISKCON, but within history, that so many people have taken on this service and been unqualified, and therefore they have problems. They fall from the path of devotional service, which is very unfortunate. But it gets back to my point just a moment ago, is how we need to see not just the form of the thing, because that's just one small part of it. We actually need to see what are the values, what are the qualities of the person. This is really what is going to propel us forward on the path of devotional service, is developing the qualities of a Vaishnava, which is mentioned, you know, in the Bhagavad Gita in the 13th chapter. And also we see there's a very interesting discussion in the last four or five chapters of the 7th canto, where Yudhisthira Maharaj has been, you know, he asked Narada Muni about Prahlad Maharaj, and some particular questions about Prahlad Maharaj. And then so Yudhisthira Maharaj talks to him about, you know, the Varna Ashram, the social orders and the spiritual orders. But in the beginning he talks about, you know, just the qualities of a human being. He lists the 30 qualities. And they're all, you know, when you actually analyze these qualities, I look at myself when I read these qualities, I think, I don't have hardly any of these qualities. And Narada Muni points out the Yudhisthira Maharaj that this is a human being. So then it causes me to think to myself, well, if I'm not a human being, what am I? You know, so we see that in the scriptures, a lot of emphasis is given towards developing qualities. And we see also in the Gita, when in the 18th chapter, when Krishna is talking about the Varnas, he talks about Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, Sudras. Yet when he talks about Brahmanas and Kshatriyas, he's talking about qualities, not activities. Where he talks about Vaishyas and Sudras, he talks about activities. Srila Prabhupada pointed out that ISKCON is a spiritual society, that ISKCON, you know, is meant to make a class of Brahmanas. So even if we don't take up Brahminical activities, we should at least try to develop these Brahminical qualities, which Srila Prabhupada was very eager that, you know, we would take up, because he understood that this would help us on our path back to Godhead. So a very important aspect of what's being discussed here, because, you know, as I was mentioning, when I got married, I had this very idealistic concept of marriage. And I was all concerned about the form, how you read in Prabhupada's books that the husband's like this, the wife is like this, the wife's supposed to serve the husband, all this kind of stuff. But, you know, growing more in devotional service and also growing the relationship with my wife, I realized that there's much more to it than just this external form. There's actually a relationship. You know? So in the same way, in devotional service, there's much more to it than just the form of wearing the cloth and you know, chanting Hare Krishna and attending Mangalati and all this stuff. There's much more to it than that. There's also the relationship we're developing with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. There's a relationship we're developing with devotees. And this is largely dependent upon our qualities. If we don't have good qualities, then what kinds of relationships will we develop? It'll be based on material things like money and position, fame. But if it's based on spiritual qualities, then the relationships become quite deep and lasting. And they can actually last beyond this body. So some very interesting points are being made here in these verses. I'll read the next purport as well. When one begins to burn firewood, there is smoke and agitation in the beginning. Anyone who's ever done a fire yogi knows that. In the first few minutes, there's smoke blowing in your face. Although there are so many disturbances in the beginning, once the fire is completely set, the firewood burns steadily. Similarly, when both husband and wife follow the regular principles of austerity, they remain silent and are not agitated by sex impulses. At such a time, both the husband and the wife are benefited spiritually. One can attain this stage of life by completely giving up a luxurious mode of life. So Srila Prabhupada is making this point here that he said, once you're not agitated by sex desire or sex impulses, the husband and wife are spiritually benefited. So the point that I see here is that as long as we have material desires, and I made this point before, this is going to block us from advancing spiritually. Well, there's no doubt, because we're in contact with the spiritual process, because we're associating with devotees, because we're serving the Supreme Personality of Godhead, we will make some advancement, there's no doubt. But it's slowed down. It's just like you've got a block of concrete on one of your feet and you're trying to walk down the road. You'll make some progress, but it's slowed down because you've got this weight holding you back. So material desires are like that. They're holding us back. They keep holding us back. There's an analogy that I heard, and it's like the disciples saying to the spiritual master, oh Guruji, the material energy is so strong she won't let go of me. And then Guru sort of became a bit thoughtful, thought, okay, I have to teach this disciple a lesson here. So then the next day, he comes, and the Guru, he's holding onto the tree. And he says, he's calling out the tree, oh, my dear tree, please let go, please let go. And the disciple comes up, Guruji, but the tree's not holding you, you're holding the tree. And he said, yes, and in the same way, you're not holding the material, the material energy's not holding you, you're holding on to the material energy. So this is the situation for at least for myself, I can't speak for all of you, but at least for myself, is that I'm holding on to these material desires. I like these things. At least externally I'm saying that, but I don't want these things. I don't want sex desire. I don't want proper distinction, adoration, these things. But actually by my actions, by the things I hold on to, by the things I hold dear, then I am holding on to these things. So in order to make tangible spiritual advancement, we need to be able to let go of all these material desires. But fortunately, with the process of devotional service, it helps us to purify ourselves of these desires. And by applying ourselves in this process, we eventually will give up these material desires. Of course, it's largely up to us how fast that is. We can make it very quickly. And as is often said, that one can become Krishna conscious in a moment. As we see, who was that king? I think it was the end of the 8th chapter. Kathvanga Maharaj. He found out that he was going to leave his body. And so in a moment, he just gave up everything and became God conscious. And there are examples like that, how great personalities. But then, if one is not a great personality, if one doesn't have any particular merit or strength, then you have to go through the process gradually. And sometimes it's a bit of a struggle. But nonetheless, if we just, as Prabhupada would say, if we just give one life to Krishna, just stick at it and give one life to Krishna, then at the end we'll go back home to Godhead without doubt. So giving one life to Krishna doesn't mean that I just stay within the four walls of ISKCON. It actually means that we have to give our life, every aspect of our life. And as many of us have probably experienced, it's not the easiest thing to do. But we just keep trying and I can look at my own life. It's interesting, when we opened the school the other day, there was some devotees visiting here from Mayapur, Bhakta and Bhakti from husband-wife team from Melbourne, who I've known since the day I walked into the temple. And then so Bhakta, he spoke for a little while, and he was talking about what I was like when I first joined the temple, and then the difference now. And you know, when I hear things like that and I look back, I can actually see that yes, I have made progress in devotional service due to the process of devotional service, due to the association of devotees, that I have made progress. And I believe that if we all do this kind of like, you know, sort of step back from our lives and have a look, I believe that we'll all see that we've made tangible advancement. And for me, this is very encouraging, because you know, when you're just absorbed in the day-to-day things of devotional service, you think, well, gee, am I making any advancement? But if you take a step back and look at the, you know, 5, 10, 20, 30 years, whatever it is we've been devotees, we can actually see that there's been significant progress there. So, it's, you know, for me, it's very encouraging. In this verse, the word chirabhasa refers to very old torn garments. The wife, especially, should remain austere, not desiring luxurious dresses and living standards. Generally, it's understood that women are more attracted to luxurious things, but it's not always the case, especially in this age when things are kind of very topsy-turvy. She should accept only the bare necessities of life and minimize her eating and sleeping. Because we see that normally men are more attracted to austerity. It's not like, you know, as I was saying, in this age, particularly modern ages, I remember years ago there was this reggae band, and they produced this song. It's Iskon reggae band. Keshi Satru, I think it was the devotee's name who did it. And there was an interesting line there. It's talking about the age of Kali. And it says, when the women all want to be the men, and the men can only remember when. So it's just pointing out to the confused nature of this age, that you know, everyone's actually confused about their duty, confused about relationships. Just, you know, I mean, yeah, anyway, I won't describe some of the strange relationships that go on in this age. She should accept only the bare necessities of life and minimize her eating and sleeping. And actually, this is for all devotees. Prabhupada would often, there's a letter he wrote to, I think it was Hansa Dutta and Himavati, when they were in Germany, and they were complaining about how they were so busy that they had hardly had any time for sleeping. Prabhupada wrote back, he said, it's very good that you are reducing your sleeping. And we see in Prabhupada's life also, he reduced his sleeping. And he talks about the six, we hear about the six Goswamis, how they reduce their sleeping almost to nil. And they're just so absorbed in hearing and chanting. So, you know, we reduce the material necessities of life to the bare necessity, just what we need. Not sleeping for comfort, not eating for comfort. You know, it's actually, you know, it's said that if one becomes fat from eating, this is another anatta which is blocking us in spiritual progress. And Srila Prabhupada would, you know, be concerned about disciples if they're overweight. There should be no question of mating. Simply by engaging in the service of her exalted husband, who must be a pure devotee, the wife will never be agitated by sex impulses. The Vanaprastha stage is exactly like this. Although the wife remains with the husband, she undergoes severe austerities and penances, so that although the husband and wife live together, there is no question of sex. The Prabhupada's like emphasizing this point quite a bit in this purport, talking about, you know, excuse me, for grihasthas moving into the Vanaprastha stage. There's no question, we have to give up all this concept of enjoying the body and just be focusing more on Krishna consciousness. In this way, both the husband and wife can live together perpetually, which is a very interesting statement. Since the wife is weaker than the husband, this weakness is expressed in this verse with the word upapatim. Upa means near to or almost equal to. And Vishnacharya Thakur, he says, near to, a little bit lower. And again, in this age of Kali Yuga, it's like, you know, it's so mixed up. Being a man, the husband is generally more advanced than his wife. Nonetheless, the wife is expected to give up all luxurious habits. She should not even dress nicely or comb her hair. Hair combing is one of the main businesses of a woman. In the Vana, I find that quite funny, actually. My wife has quite long hair, so on the hair wash day, she's got to spend quite a lot of time combing her hair. So I thought of her when I read that. It's quite funny. In the Vanaprastha stage, the wife should not take care of her hair. Thus, her hair will become tangled in knots. Consequently, the wife will no longer be attractive to the husband, and she herself will no longer be agitated by sex impulses. In this way, both the husband and wife can advance in spiritual consciousness. So Prabhupada's made this same point several times in these two purports, by giving up material desires. That's how we make tangible, like really, not just like, you know, slow, steady advancement, but real solid and rapid advancement in Krishna consciousness. Because this is the thing that slows us down. We often hear questions, well, how do I make advancement? Why aren't I making, you know, you hear stories about how, you know, in the past times of Ramanujacharya, you know, some fish got his remnants, and they took on spiritual bodies, went back home to Godhead. You know, because they don't have all these types of desires slowing them down. But because we hold on to our conditionings, we hold on to our material desires, our anarthas, our parties, we hold on to these things, this is blocking us from making, you know, rapid spiritual advancement. Because if you look at it in the context of, you look at ourselves, you look at the nature of the spiritual process, you know, if we fully surrender to the spiritual process, if we fully surrender to Krishna consciousness, it's so powerful, it'll, you know, propel us forward like a rocket. You know, it just makes such rapid advancement. But because we're not actually getting onto it properly, you know, it's like when I was a child, we used to ride on our push bikes. And push bikes, you know what they're like. You can go, you know, if you really push it hard, maybe 35, 40, maybe a really good 45 kilometers an hour. That's quite fast. But sometimes there'd be a truck going past and we'd grab the back of the truck. Whoosh, off we'd go, you know, 60 kilometers an hour. No effort at all. Didn't even have to pedal. So spiritual life's like that, you know. We're trying to go along on our push bikes and really going hard and huffing and puffing and sweating to make some advancement in spiritual life. But if we just grab on to Krishna consciousness and give ourselves to it fully, then we'll just be propelled forward with no endeavor whatsoever. I'm not meaning we just don't do anything, but, you know, we'll make rapid advancement in Krishna consciousness quite easily, just by giving up the material desires. But that's the struggle we're all faced with. This advanced stage is called the Paramahansa stage, and once it is obtained, both husband and wife can be actually liberated from bodily consciousness. If the disciple remains steady in the service of the spiritual master, he need no longer fear falling down into the clutches of Maya. So, it's just like, I was reflecting on this morning when I was taking darshan of Nrisingadev, because I always stand near the pillar. I take shelter of the pillar, because what happens in the morning, there's usually a rush of devotees wanting to get in to take darshan of Nrisingadev, and I'm not so steady on my feet, so I'm always concerned that I might get knocked over and, you know, wind up getting squashed underneath the lotus feet of the devotees. And then I was reflecting on that. It was like, you know, so this is just like taking shelter of the spiritual master. It's like taking shelter of Krishna. It's like, you know, it's immovable. It doesn't matter how hard the devotees push or how many devotees are pushing, they're never going to move that column. So in the same way, if we can take shelter of the lotus feet of the spiritual master, lotus feet of Nrisingadev and Srila Prabhupada, then we become firmly fixed in our vows, become firmly fixed in devotional service, and Maya can't affect us. And Krishna says that in the 7th chapter, that, you know, those who take shelter of him, he said that this material nature is very difficult to overcome. You know, it's just like, if you've ever been out on a yacht or a boat, you know, and you get out so you can't see land, and it's like, it's quite a different experience. It's down in the middle of the sea, you can't see land anywhere. You know, how are you going to swim back to shore? How are you going to swim anywhere? Just on your own, if the boat sunk. And it happens all the time. They have these ocean races where the yachts, they crash or they break or the storm comes and smashes them, and people fall into the sea and they're lost at sea. No chance for rescue. So the material nature is like that. You know, if we dive into the material ocean, there's no chance of us being rescued. But Krishna is pointing out, and he makes, you know, the similar points made in the 14th chapter of the 10th canto, that if we just take shelter of the boat of the lotus feet of the Lord, then this material ocean, it just shrinks to such a tiny drop of water that it becomes insignificant. Because that's the difference between the spiritual and the material situation. The spiritual is so vast, the material is so small. It's insignificantly small when you compare it to the spiritual nature. But because we've taken shelter of the material nature, we think it's the all in all, and it consumes us completely. And that's, you know, that expression of Prabhupada was some, that expression Prabhupada coined when a devotee leaves ISKCON, it's like they bloop. And one time he explained, it's like when you drop a pebble into mud, it goes bloop. And you don't see anything, it's gone. There's no trace. So it's like that. The material nature, if we absorb ourselves in the material nature, we disappear without a trace. But then by becoming, and you know, it's so completely consumed by it. But if we can allow ourselves to be consumed by the spiritual process, then, you know, we'll actually make rapid advancement back to the lotus feet of Krishna. So I'll finish. Are there any questions at all? You want to comment?
Hare Krishna, you mentioned the form as not being quite, you know, reliable sometimes. So we, in the earlier part of your lecture, then we started to delve into the purport, and Prabhupada is talking about how a wife should wear tattered clothes and not comb her hair and so forth. So we find, I mean, even myself, after so many years of being schooled in austerity and so forth, that kind of behavior on the part of a woman or a man, you know, is kind of repulsive, because you think, oh, this person's not clean, you know. So how do we discriminate and discern between what is a spiritual person, you know, just because he's tattered, or he or she is tattered and unkept? How do we discriminate there? It seemed like something was left out in that purport. Obviously, if that person is chanting Hare Krishna constantly, then we could have, you know, a lot of appreciation. But if that person is just appearing, we may not have that appreciation. So form can be very deceptive. Mm. How can we figure it out?
Yeah, I don't think, personally, I don't think anything was left out in the purport, because Srila Prabhupada talks about, and also the verse talks about, how she was constantly engaged in the service of her husband, who was a Mahabhagavat. So that there's her process of devotional service right there, because she's serving a great devotee. And just because someone's not taking care of their hair, it doesn't mention they're not bathing. Just like we see with Devahuti, she describes in the verses there how she was bathing regularly. Just not getting into all the sort of finery of combing her hair and putting on makeup and, you know, spending 3.5 days in front of the mirror before they come out to go somewhere. You know, so all that, you know, is, you know, like, not there. Because it's just, why do people do things like that? Why does a living entity do that? Why do they decorate their body? To attract somebody else. That's all it's for, is just to attract, you know. And in this case, it's talking about the husband and the wife. You know, they're making themselves look, you know, presentable for their partner. In this day and age, mostly, you know, at least outside of Islam, you see the people, even husbands and wives, they're decorating themselves up to attract someone else besides their partner, such as the nature of relationships. But in terms of being able to discriminate, particularly, I mean, obviously the symptoms that are given in, you know, for instance, the Madhuri Kadambini, other books like that, but to determine who's actually a greatly advanced devotee, my understanding is that requires someone who's similarly advanced. You know, to determine who's a Mahabhagavat, that's the Mahabhagavat can determine who's a Mahabhagavat. From my perspective, I couldn't do it. Okay.
So the other question I have is about the spiritual master being accepted as good as God. This is very difficult, considering that some devotees feel they've been cheated. They, you know, accepted like this, and then there was a fall down. When those events happened in the past, recent past and far past, I always felt that, of course, because we're guarded by the Shastra, because the Shastra talks about what to do if the guru falls down. How do we deal with the emotional reaction that devotees naturally have if they find themselves in that predicament?
I went through that experience. I was previously initiated by Bhavananda, so I'm quite familiar with that experience. And I didn't feel cheated at all. I didn't get emotional about it. I mean, of course, I was disturbed that he left the practice of devotional service after so many years of, you know, I mean, he practically built Mayapur with he and Jai Patakamar. So much endeavor they put in here. And of course, you know, from my perspective, I was always concerned that he would again take the devotional service, and, you know, because I see by his sacrifice, by his preaching, it brought me to ISKCON. So I never felt badly towards him. I never felt any animosity or anything like that, because I just would think of what he'd done for me. You know, he I mean, previously I was a drug addict. I mean, I was addicted to heroin and so many different things. But, you know, he dragged me out of that situation by his preaching. So, you know, just a sense of gratitude. I think, like, for me, because I've, you know, many of my God brothers and God sisters from the time did become inimical and did become disturbed by the whole thing. The one thing that I found that helped me was that the leaders in the Australian Yatra remained quite solid. And, you know, so I had that sangha of advanced devotees, and they also preached strongly. And I remember one time one of the devotees was asking my Swami after Bhavananda left. He said, well, you know, what's he going to, he's saying, what's Bhavananda going to do now? And Ramai Swami answered, I thought it was a good answer at the time. He said, it's not important right now what Bhavananda's going to do. What's important is what are you going to do? Which I thought was quite, you know, a wise response. Because that's the thing. It's like, are we surrendering to a person who's practicing devotional service, or are we surrendering to the principle or the process of devotional service? I feel that if we put our emphasis on the person, then it becomes a personality cult. You know, what we're surrendering to is their, you know, the fact is that they're connected to the process of devotional service. They're in the fire of bhakti. And as long as they're in the fire of bhakti, they're qualified. As soon as they remove themselves from the fire of bhakti, they're just a jiva like anyone else. They're no different from any other living entity on this planet. But if they're in the fire of devotional service, they're connected. Then they have the potential. You know, what's that the verse that in the Chaitanya Charita, the one who's empowered by Krishna can give the holy name to others. So as long as one's connected, then they're able to, you know, give that to others. But, you know, so when you connect yourself to a person rather than the process, and that person leaves ISKCON, because it's going to happen, it's just the reality of the material world. You know, is giving up material desires is not an easy thing to do. So when that person leaves, if you're, and we saw that, you know, with so many, you know, it's like whole yatras practically would leave because the guru left. But what a waste of life. You spent like 10, 20, 30 years practicing devotional service. The person you take diksha from leaves and you give it up. What a loss. What a huge, momentous loss that is, you know. So, you know, I was determined not to have that happen to me. So, you know, I just used that as an impetus to take more shelter of the process and devotees. And I think that's just how we need to encourage people who go through that. I mean, I know devotees who've had three spiritual masters leave, and I'm sure others here know that as well. You know? And, you know, they just soldier on and understanding it's the process. See, it's the process of devotional service. You know, yes, the guru delivers this as long as he's connected. As soon as he's no longer connected, what's his capacity to deliver a person? As long as the mic wire is plugged into the microphone. The microphone's a transducer. I used to be one of these guys that did this. The microphone's a transducer. Transducer means it converts one type of energy into another type of energy. So it's using like a you know, like the air is moving and it's turning into electrical energy. So as long as this is connected to the electricity, it's going to function. But as soon as you pull the plug out, you see the electricity runs out and you can hear the sound go down. So it's the same with in the spiritual process. As long as a devotee is connected to the powerhouse of Krishna, he's able to deliver people. As soon as that connection is broken, he can't do it. Even though he may look like a guru. And we've seen that, you know, with certain personalities who have been around in ISKCON and left and stuff like that. They continue to think of themselves as guru, present themselves as guru, but it's actually a charade because they have no capacity to deliver. So for me, the thing is like to help devotees understand how it's the process, it's the name that actually delivers. And as long as that person is connected. In a lecture, Prabhupada explained that, he said, actually, I'm not your friend. You know, because he's talking about that verse, Bhakti Vangana from some. And he said, Krishna is your only friend. But I can be your friend in as much as I can show you Krishna. I can take you and introduce you to Krishna. So that's the reality of our situation. It's like guru, you know, sadhu, whatever. It's like all they can do is connect us to Krishna. They can show us Krishna, introduce him. You know, we shake his hand, things like that. But they, you know, independent of the process of devotional service, they have no capacity to deliver. It's only through the process and one's connection to the process that we have that capacity. Sri Nathji Prabhu. Hare Krishna. Krishna. Thank you for a wonderful lecture. I was always keen to see you and hear from you. We've known each other for about 30 years.
I'm blessed by your association.
I'm at your lotus feet. So, may I comment on this? Because we were on the same platform, in one sense. You said that the Guru is like the one who gives you a connection or introduction to Krishna. And Prabhuji here, I can't see him behind the wall, but mentioned about the Guru having difficulties. So we also had gone through a similar phase as you did, Kirtananda Swami's matter. And I feel it's like a relay race, you know, where we have these GBC other members, godbrothers of our gurus, willing to take up the baton as soon as one of them trips. And we've seen it in the race so many times. The guy's running so hard and panting all the time, he trips. And he is about to drop the baton, and then somebody else picks it up and runs and gives it to you. I think it's more like that, that the connection remains through the GBC members. And that's why Prabhupada had this wonderful GBC system.
Yeah. As long as we're connected to the Parampara, because it says, Sampradaya Vihini Aye Mantraste Nishpalamataha, that actually, as long as you're connected to a bona fide spirit, Sampradaya, then you actually get the benefit of that Sampradaya. But as soon as we deviate from the process and we think that we can do it independently, it stops working.
One more comment about Narhari Shastri, section 132 of his book. The devotee or disciple tries his best to see that his guru doesn't fall down. And even if he falls down, he tries to help him. And that's the duty of a disciple, even if the guru falls down. And though he may take a reinitiation, he continues to help the person who helped him.
Hare Krishna. Thank you. Anything else? Mahaprabhu.
You mentioned the word bloop. So Chutananda Prabhu in Lachwa told us the story about the origin of this word, which is quite interesting. As you mentioned, Prabhupada gave the example of a rock dropping in water, and it makes a sound. But he didn't mention the sound, he just said it makes a sound. The living entity falls. So some devotee thought, yes, it makes the sound bloop. And so when the first devotee left ISKCON, he coined that term. And so Prabhupada asked, where so-and-so? And the devotee said, oh, Prabhupada, he blooped. So Prabhupada didn't know what the word bloop meant, because bloop is not an English word. It was made up by that devotee on the spot. And Prabhupada said, what is this bloop? Because nobody knew what the word was. And he said, oh, Prabhupada, he left. And then the devotee explained, you know, the rock. And then Prabhupada said, if he bloop, then what can be done? So Prabhupada accepted the word. And that's the origin of the word bloop.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki. Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki. Jai Nityananda Prabhu. Thank you.